Where there is no guidance, a people falls, but in the abundance of counselors, there is safety. That's Proverbs 11:14. Hi, I'm Rob West. The words of that verse apply to all areas of Christian life, including financial stewardship. According to God's financial principles, good counsel is important for managing his money wisely. Dr. Art Rayner joins us today to talk about it. Then we have lots of great listener questions ahead, but we won't be taking your live calls today because this program is pre-recorded. This is Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. Well, it's always great to have our friend Art Rayner back with us. Art is a frequent contributor at FaithFi and director of the Institute for Christian Financial Health, where they have something really special underway. It's the Certified Christian Financial Counselor Program, or CERT-CFC for short. Art, great to have you back with us.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Art, give our folks an idea of what a Certified Christian Financial Counselor does for folks who need help getting their finances in order.
There are many people out there who feel like their finances are just out of control. They struggle to make and keep a budget. Yeah. They want to get out of debt and know what it feels like to pay for a car with cash. They are tired of living paycheck to paycheck, and they want to feel the freedom to give more generously and have more margin in their finances. So what does a Certified Christian Financial Counselor do? Well, using the Bible as a guide, Certified Christian Financial Counselors help and educate individuals and couples in these core areas of personal finances. So budgeting, getting out of debt, avoiding paycheck to paycheck living, saving for future expenses, and living more generously.
And I suspect many of our listeners right now are saying, that's me. I could use more of that. Let's talk about the training, Art. I know the training is rigorous. Give us a sense of what these counselors go through.
You're correct. Certified Christian Financial Counselors go through a rigorous program that covers various subjects like biblical stewardship, budget management, debt elimination, saving for future expenses, and preventing paycheck to paycheck living. After going through the program, they must pass a 2-hour, 100-question examination to receive their designation.
Really important to get great training, and I know there's a good bit of oversight in that as well. Perhaps there's some confusion, though, Art, about the difference between a financial counselor and a financial advisor. Explain the difference in your view.
Yeah, that's a great question. If you're looking for someone to help you with your investments, retirement planning, risk management, or tax planning, you are looking for a financial advisor. So certified Christian financial counselors do not provide specific investment or tax advice. While this explanation is not perfect, you could say that financial advisors help people with their long-range planning, while certified Christian financial counselors help people with the here and now issues that they are facing.
Yeah, that's a great distinction there. Now, what about those in our listening audience today, Art, who are thinking, I might like to help others in this area? I have a passion for financial stewardship. What would you say to them?
Rob, the need for certified Christian financial counselors is great. We need an army of men and women who want to help others discover and pursue God's design for money. The Certified Christian Financial Counselor is for you. If you're passionate about what the Bible says about money, you love helping people take that next step in their personal finances, or you want to start your own financial counseling practice or serve in your church. Of course, a lot of certified Christian financial counselors actually do both of those.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then if someone reaches out and connects with a CERT-CFC, what might they expect?
Well, first, if you need help, just realize that you are not alone. Many, if not most, Americans could benefit from meeting with a certified Christian financial counselor. When you do connect with one, you will find someone who will listen to your story and financial challenges with empathy. Certified Christian financial counselors have a passion for helping others. They will provide you with a biblical perspective on your challenges and teach you how to move forward in your finances practically. Most of the time, the counselors operate on a 1-hour session basis, but this can vary depending on the certified Christian financial counselor.
Yeah. And I love that you said it's going to be biblical. There's lots of encouragement, but it's also practical. So you're going to come away with real action steps, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. How can folks get more information?
Well, whether you are looking for a certified Christian financial counselor or you desire to become one, you can find more information at ChristianFinancialHealth.com.
That's ChristianFinancialHealth.com. We love the CERT CFC. It's the right thing for so many of you looking to get on God's page with regard to how you manage His money. Art, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Art Rayner, Director of the Institute for Christian Financial Health. Learn more at ChristianFinancialHealth.com. As I said, we're off today, so don't call in, but we've got some great calls lined up in advance, so we'll go to those just around the corner. I'm Rob West, and we'll be right back. Hey, great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. I'm so glad you're along with us today. Here's my hope and prayer is that over the rest of this hour, we'd be an encouragement to you in your financial journey, that as you take on this role of being a steward each day of God's resources and you have questions and you realize you've made some mistakes like I have and you're trying to get it right and just hear well done, good and faithful servant someday, that we can kind of encourage you along that path and be there cheering you on, provide you some wise counsel from God's word and help you navigate the challenges related to financial decision-making. Because I realize it can be overwhelming, especially in times like this when expenses are up across the board and we've got a really strong stock market, but we don't know where it's going. And we're trying to be good stewards in terms of our giving. And we maybe got some debt that we've accumulated, would like to get rid of it. I realize all of those things apply to so many of you. And we want to help you make wise decisions. Before we take those questions, let me just say once again, as we lead by providing this radio broadcast and our new studies and devotionals and our publication that's going to be coming out early next year alongside the FaithFi app and all the plans we have for that, we want to be this community of stewards that come together to encourage each other. And if you'd like to help support that work, this is a really important time. Some generous donors have come together to say, we know that you have a goal of $300,000 in giving by the end of the year. We want to provide half of it, which means we can double every gift that comes in between now and December 31st. So a gift of 50 is 100, a gift of 100 is 200, gifts of 1,000 or 5,000 will be doubled as well. It all goes toward finishing our year strong here at FaithFi so we can continue on in the new year with all of the exciting things we have planned. So if you've been blessed by the ministry and you'd take a moment just right now to visit our website at faithfi.com and click give, that's faithfi.com and click give. Your gift right now and continuing through the end of the year will be doubled up to $150,000. It would be an incredible blessing to us. And so you can head there at your convenience, faithfi.com, click give, and thanks in advance. All right, we're ready to dive into your questions today. We're going to begin in West Virginia. Doug, thanks for calling, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you, Rob, for taking my call.
Sure.
About a year and a half ago, I was hospitalized for about 5 days, and everything went well, and everything's gone well since, until I received a $2,800 bill from a physician's group that was supposedly attending to me. I called my insurance company and asked them about this, and they said that they usually close out a case 3 months after the, you know, I leave the hospital, and they will not even reopen a case after 6 months. So I also called the hospital and they told me the same thing. They were familiar with the physicians group. And so here I am holding a $2,800 bill, and it would have been, if the physicians group would have been, have done their job, it would have probably been 100% paid. But since they dropped the ball on this, now they want me to pay $2,800. And I'm just wondering if there's any recourse with this.
Yeah. Boy, I'm so sorry to hear that, Doug. Yeah, this is a really challenging situation. And obviously, it seems like they're even acknowledging that it's the medical provider's negligence, both the insurance company and the hospital. Have you spoken to the office manager at the medical provider's office? Have they accepted responsibility for this?
I have. I'm supposed to call back within 1 to 2 weeks and to see if they can, they said to see if they can make adjustments on the bill. But it, you know, I keep coming back to the fact that if they were doing their job, this bill would have been paid and settled a year and a half ago.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a relationship with the physician?
No, it was the physician's group that was, I don't know what you call it, appointed by the hospital. It was actually different physicians coming in over the 5 days to attend to me.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's just going to take some legwork here. I mean, I might be up for, if it were me, paying an in-person visit to sit down with the office manager and just talk this through face-to-face, make sure they understand the situation that both the hospital and the insurance company are saying, because of their negligence, this is a matter that's unable to be paid. Obviously, getting a negotiated lower amount just seems like a no-brainer, but in this case, you would have not come out of pocket even a penny for all intents and purposes if they would have done their job. And so I think making them aware of that, seeing if they would just write it off completely, would be step one. Step two, I think, would be to submit a formal complaint to the medical provider, and it might be worth having an attorney draft that for you. You certainly could also file a complaint with the Consumer Protection Division. In your case, it would be the West Virginia Attorney General's Office at AGO.gov. And then you could also contact the West Virginia Insurance Commissioner's Office as well. You know, I think at the end of the day, you know, worst case is you get a negotiated lower amount with a payment plan that fits very well within your budget and you pay it out over time. But I think, you know, working toward getting this completely written off should be your first objective. And I think that starts by you sitting down with, you know, the office manager or somebody who's, you know, over the billing department of the physician group.
Yeah, I don't even think there's actually a local office for me to contact, because when I called them, I can't even remember where it was, like Chicago or something like that. And it's one of those, you're on hold for 45 minutes just to get a customer service rep.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I think your best option at this point then is to do everything in writing so you have that paper trail that you can use if it ever came to, you know, a judgment of some kind, and also to document this just, you know, for the insurance company as well. So I'd probably either yourself write that letter or have an attorney write one for you, send it to the physicians group, you know, and tell them you want a response in writing that you're asking that this be written off in full because of their negligence in submitting this invoice, which would have been paid on a timely basis, but because of the fact that they did not take care of it on a timely basis, it's unable to be paid through the normal channels, and get them to respond to you in writing, either that they're willing to comply, or if not, why not, and what they're willing to do. So I'm really sorry, Doug. I hate this for you, but hopefully that'll get you pointed in the right direction. Let us know how it turns out. All the best to you. So glad to hear you're doing well health-wise. That's great news.
Let me mention, folks, if you haven't checked out the FaithFi app, we'd love for you to do that. Think about this. Inside the app, there is a community of stewards that are sharing best practices, asking questions, encouraging each other on their stewardship journeys, and there's no cost to participate in that. Also, all of our broadcast archives are there, and we bring together the best content in biblical finance anywhere in our Learn tab. And then you could also use the Money Management, the spending plan portion, if you want. It's based on Larry Burkett's digital envelope system. It's all in the FaithFi app. Go to faithfi.com and click app. You can download it today. As a reminder, we're not here today, so don't call in, but we'll be back with more questions right after this. So thankful to have you with us today on Faith and Finance as we provide a hopeful, encouraging, biblical message of financial decision making. You know, it's all about looking through the lens of Scripture, holding what God has entrusted to us loosely so we can give generously. I would submit that's the primary purpose for which God has entrusted resources to us, clearly to provide for ourselves and our families. But I think so often we get stuck in an endless list of needs and wants, never getting beyond that to the opportunity to serve those on our path and be generous, supporting the work of the Lord. Think about that today as you consider your role as a steward in managing God's money. Let's go to St. Joseph, Missouri. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, I retire and I have had a TSA and I transferred to an IRA account. It's drawing 3%, and they said I could take some of that money and invest into the stock. I don't know if I should do that or just let it sit and draw 3%.
Yeah. So have you separated from service, Mike, or are you still?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So you have the ability to roll that whole thing out to an IRA. What have you built up in that TSA account?
$40,000.
Okay. And are you transitioning into retirement or are you still working?
No, I retired August 1st.
Okay, very good. And what other retirement assets do you have?
I got a retirement from the school district, Peers.
Okay.
Social Security.
Yep. Excellent. So with the Peers and the Social Security, the monthly checks, does the total of the two give you enough to cover your bills, and do you have any left over?
Yeah, it does. I took out my Peers that gave me an option to do a partial lump sum. I took $80,000 and this had been some stocks,
okay.
Mutual funds.
Got it. So the portion that they're giving you in a monthly check, that plus Social Security is enough to cover your bills?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not having to pull anything from the $80,000.
No, I'm not going to touch that.
Okay.
I can't touch.
Yeah, great.
I don't have to touch it until I turn 73.
Okay. Why 73?
Well, that's the federal government requires you to start drawing out of.
Oh, you're talking about a required minimum distribution. Got it. And who's managing that $80,000?
New York Life.
Okay. And so is that in a guaranteed product, or what type of product do you have it in?
It's just mutual funds. I don't know if it's
okay.
Guaranteed. It's not guaranteed, I don't think.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so you've got the same option here with the $40,000. When you roll that to an IRA, it's below what you would typically need to have an advisor who would take over what's called discretion, meaning they would make the buy and sell decisions for you. Now, if you combined it with the $80,000 and you had $120,000, you could probably get an advisor to manage the whole thing. Other than that, you know, you could move the $40,000 to an IRA potentially with New York Life. That wouldn't be my first choice, though, just because I would prefer you to keep it outside of an insurance company. But if you did roll it to an IRA, you essentially have an unlimited number of investment options. You know, typically with somebody who's headed into retirement, you know, you might have a 60-40 portfolio where you got 60% in bonds for income and stability, and then maybe 30-40% in stocks for some growth potential, and then maybe 5-10% in precious metals, and then you might have the rest in cash and cash equivalents. And then that would make up a properly diversified portfolio. And with $40,000, you wouldn't be buying individual stocks and bonds. You would use mutual funds or index funds. You could even use something called a target date fund, which makes it really simple, where, you know, you'd pick a target date, you know, for your situation, maybe even one just 5 years out, and then it would automatically manage the money for you. So I think the next step is to decide, are you looking to try to delegate this to someone else to oversee this, or are you comfortable managing this yourself?
Well, right now it's guaranteed 3%.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think the idea here, though, is that you can do better than that, especially if you're willing to take a little bit of risk.
And, you know, even when you're entering retirement, I mean, you know, if you're in good health, you need to try to think about this $120,000, the 80 plus the 40 lasting for the next probably, you know, 3 decades or more. And so that gives you the ability to say, okay, I can invest this knowing that, you know, even though the market's doing well right now, we're bound to hit a recession here in the next few years because the economy is cyclical. And so, but that's okay because the portion that's in stocks, I wouldn't touch it. I'd let it recover. But that gives you kind of the growth engine. And then again, the bonds and, you know, the cash and cash equivalents provide more of the fixed income, stability, that type of thing. And so, you know, if you want to manage it yourself, you could roll it to a Fidelity or a Schwab into an IRA. That's not a taxable event. And then you'd pick the investments, maybe the index funds or a target date fund, or you could pick from one of the faith-based investing mutual funds. If you want to have somebody do it for you, you could use a robo-advisor like the Schwab Intelligent Portfolios. You could combine it with your lump sum from PERS, or you know, you could use maybe a service like soundmindinvesting.org, some great partners of ours where they would provide you the mutual funds to pick from, you know, each month or each quarter. But I think you've got a number of options there. But I think at the end of the day, I kind of like the idea of you rolling it out of the TSA into the IRA and then making sure your investment selections match your age and your risk tolerance, which means in this season of life, you're going to skew more heavily toward bonds and fixed income and lesser so toward the stocks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. So I think that's where you're going next. And I think your next step is just to decide what's the right investment strategy for you. Again, you could make the buy and sell decisions on your own, go to Fidelity or Schwab, roll it to an IRA, and you know, you could use index funds. You could use a robo like the Schwab Intelligent Portfolios. You could go to soundmindinvesting.org or you know, any number of the faith-based investing fund families on our website at faithfi.com would be a great choice for you as well. But listen, Mike, all the best to you in this next season of life. Don't hesitate to call if we can help you with anything else. I've got to take a break. We'll be right back. We're so glad you're along with us today on Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. Our goal, our hope and prayer for you is that you would see God as your ultimate treasure as we explore God's word as it relates to money decisions. We'll be headed to Julie in Michigan, Tom's in Minnesota, but first Michael in North Carolina. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, thank you. Two parts to the question. One is I wonder if you can enlighten me some and then I'll get specific. So what triggers a credit card fraud alert on an account? What are the algorithms that trigger that so that when the credit card company contacts you?
Yeah. You know, they don't tell you specifically because that's changing all the time. You know, they're constantly improving, especially these days where, you know, fraud is just rampant and the fraudsters are constantly coming up with new ways to compromise your data and get access to it. And, you know, at the same time, the credit card companies are increasingly becoming very skilled at identifying fraud. And so they use everything from patterns to geography to whether or not, you know, there's multiple transactions in a row, whether it's a vendor that you use frequently or not. I mean, there's very complicated algorithms that would trigger a fraud alert. And, you know, that's all proprietary. Nevertheless, it's helpful as long as you have the right communication channels set up, whether it's text alerts or email or otherwise, maybe, you know, a notification on their app that you might have on their phone for you to be made aware of, you know, whenever their system triggers a fraud alert to be able to respond, you know, hopefully quickly, just to say, yes, this is me, or no, it's not. And then if it's a no, for you to take additional steps to understand, you know, what went down, who the merchant was, and, you know, whether or not this is truly fraud. But as to the parameters, the specifics around what causes those triggers, that would not be something that would be able to be made available because it's just constantly changing.
All right. Then specifically, my credit card company did contact me with a fraud alert. I called them and said, no, it's not my charge. And so I've talked to four people, but now they're saying it is my charge. And along with the charge, they're charging me late fees and, you know, no payment fees because they said, well, don't pay it. So I didn't pay it, of course, because it wasn't mine. So what's your next step if they sent you the fraud alert, but then they said it is your charge? And, it, you know, of course, it isn't. But what's my next step? I mean,
yeah. Yeah,
I don't want to not pay it and have lousy credit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So did you put a formal dispute in that resulted in an investigation where they said, let us look into it and then we'll come back to you with a decision?
Yes.
Okay. And so did you get a decision in writing that they were denying or they had reason to believe that this was, in fact, a legitimate charge?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so did they give you an option to, you know, come back to them with something else, or was it kind of the case is closed, so to speak?
Well, the case is closed and I, you know, the charges stand and the interest stands and the fees stand.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You know, it's a good question. I mean, what I would probably do is prepare a dispute letter with your name, account number, contact information, a detailed explanation of the disputed charge, the reasons for disputing the charge that, you know, this is a merchant you've never used, an unauthorized charge, and state clearly the resolution you seek, which is a refund and full removal of any charges and interest, and then send it to the billing inquiry address on your statement. And then I'd keep records of all of it and follow up. Now, if at the end of the day, they just are unwilling, well, you know, at that point, you know, you could escalate this to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and file a complaint or your local attorney general's office for additional, you know, assistance there. But it's, you know, obviously at that point, it becomes very challenging to get any kind of resolution. How much are we talking about here?
It's under $200. It's just the fact that it's not mine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally get it. And I'm not saying you should just completely acquiesce. Well, I think your next step after you do the kind of verbal dispute and you get the response is to do that formal dispute in writing and, you know, get this, see if you can escalate this to another department and give the reason for your disagreement with their decision. And then, you know, I would check your credit report as well for any unusual activity just to ensure that this issue doesn't affect your credit score. You know, fraudulent charges can sometimes lead to, you know, further identity theft or be evidence of further identity theft. And then I think at the end of the day, if you can't get them to resolve it and you just have to pay it because you don't want to continue to accrue interest, then I think that's where a complaint to the CFPB would certainly be in order as a next step.
Okay, and repeat those initials one more time. CFPB.
Yeah, it's CFPB, which is Consumer CFPB. Financial Protection
okay.
Bureau, is okay. Basically the consumer, the government agency that represents consumers in these matters.
Okay, appreciate right. your insight. Thank
Absolutely,
you.
Michael. Thanks for your call today. To Pine River, Minnesota, Tom. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, Rob, I have a question about gold. If I
All
should
right.
physically buy it and put it into a safe deposit box or into a safe, or should I do it kind of like how crypto is? It's just out there, I own it, but I don't have physical access to it.
Yeah, or Tom, perhaps there's door number three, which is both. So I like physical gold and I like the electronic gold. I think precious metals deserve a place in a properly diversified portfolio. And we've seen, you know, evidence of that recently with just the performance of gold. I mean, even though it's pulled back a bit since the election, and I think it will continue. And largely the reason is because with the Trump victory, along with the Republican House and likely House and for sure Senate, that those are all pro-growth type, you know, of administrations and, you know, policies that we're going to see coming out of Republican Congress and the presidency. And because of that, it, you know, removes some of the luster, if you will, no pun intended, of gold, because that's more of a fear trade. Whereas if we have growth, you know, you're going to see some of the run-up sell off. Now, why would I have it in a portfolio, even though it doesn't generate any income? Because it's an uncorrelated asset, and so it helps to further diversify your overall portfolio, and it's a fear trade. It's a store of value. So if, you know, everything goes haywire, you know, that it typically does well. And, you know, that's a good thing, you know, as you look at, you know, your options for what you can put in the portfolio. Now, in terms of how you'd break down that allocation, typically what I would say is for somebody who wants to add the precious metals, you might want to think about it in terms of a 5% forever allocation. And that's where you'd buy the physical gold. And I'd probably keep it in a fireproof safe, or you certainly could use a safe deposit box. And then the other 5% buy, like, with an ETF like GLD or one of the gold trackers. The reason is, if you wanted to reduce your overall allocation, it's very easy to do that with the electronic gold ETF tracker, much more difficult to do with the physical gold. And so that's why that's the portion that you just hang on to. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Tom. God bless you. We're going to take a break and be back right after this. Don't go anywhere. Thanks for joining us today on Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. Let's see. Head to Michigan. Julie, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The complex problem I have is that we are all aging children. My oldest sibling is very gifted in many ways, but he's also bipolar and doesn't have any sense about what to do with money. If you have it, then you use it or you give it.
Yeah.
His good friend from another state has a terminal illness, and he wanted to be able to leave some money to my brother, but he needed it to be controlled, and it asked me to be the executor, which I'll be glad to do. But I have questions that come up from that and then from calling for a little more information. I don't know. I know it'll be a pretty sizable amount. I don't know an amount because he doesn't know how long he's living, but I would guess somewhere in the $200,000 to $500,000 range. So I'm investigating that. I called Vanguard, who he's working with, and they explained that the taxes, the executor is the one that has taxes to pay, because the person who's actually getting it is not named anywhere on this on the inheritance.
Yeah.
So this is a let's see. Okay, so I had contacted Vanguard and was told to call there and tell them I'm calling about a non-spousal inherited IRA Act number. You want the number?
No, that's okay.
Okay. You'll need the date of his passing.
Okay.
Check with his spouse. Give me a phone number. They may want a copy of my death certificate. The benefit is taxable. I think this should give you enough to go on.
Yeah. And so you're just wondering what your responsibilities would be if you served in that role as executor?
No, we're more concerned with what would be our tax. Would we be as the try to get the words out, Julie. As the executor, would we need to pay the entire tax when that whole amount is put into my care? Or is that something that we pay month by month or every other month, whenever the money is needed by my brother?
Yeah. Well, as an executor, you would be responsible for ensuring that all federal taxes owed by the deceased and their estate are properly filed and paid. So that would be a normal and customary thing. But this person probably has their own executor. They're just wanting to entrust this to your care for the benefit of your your sibling. Is that right?
Yes, sibling. And yes, his spouse is the executor of what does not coming through for my brother.
Yeah. Okay. So any estate taxes that he would owe would be handled prior to the inheritance that's coming. The inheritance would then be paid out to the beneficiaries. There is no federal inheritance tax currently, and as of 2024, only six states impose an inheritance tax: Iowa, Kentucky, Maryland, Nebraska, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. So that likely wouldn't apply. The only thing you would have would be then income tax on certain types of inherited assets that generate income after the inheritance is received. But there shouldn't be any inheritance. There's not federal inheritance tax. The estate tax would be taken care of by the deceased's estate. And so there really shouldn't be any tax liability there unless, again, these assets generate income from the date after you receive them. And then that would be based on who the beneficiary is. That would be the person that is in charge of paying the income tax moving forward. Probably a good idea to check with a CPA. But I think the other issue is just how this is going to be paid out and to whom and in what form. Because, you know, it could be paid to a special needs trust if your sibling would qualify, and then a trustee would be named, and then it could be distributed according to the trust itself. It could be paid to a revocable trust that could be set up where, you know, it could be paid out for the benefit of your sibling at certain intervals or over time or based on certain triggering events to make sure he doesn't receive a lump sum. But all that would need to be set up in advance by, you know, the person who currently has the assets so that it's paid directly to the trust. In this case, if it's paid directly to your sibling as a beneficiary, you know, he has the ability to do what he wants with it. So I think that needs to happen as a part of the estate planning on the part of his friend. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just looking to see if I know that we've talked about it on the phone different times. I just know that I am, let's see, the executor. It becomes my name, inherited IRA. Let's say Julie, whatever my last name is, inherited IRA is what it becomes, that portion.
So he's leaving it directly to you as the beneficiary and just asking you to use it for the benefit of your sibling?
Right.
Okay.
He knows me fairly well, knows that I know the Lord and trusts me. And then if there's money left, if my sibling dies first, then I would return that to his spouse.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think that's the key here is that it would come into the IRA. That's not a taxable event. You would be responsible for the taxes that would have to be paid anytime a distribution is made because it's your asset. So I think the key would be if your intention is every time you take a distribution, and it would likely have to be distributed over 10 years, every time you make a distribution, you would want to hold back from that distribution the amount of tax that would be generated by the withdrawal. And you'd work with a CPA to determine what that is so that you don't get hit with a big tax bill unexpectedly.
Right. That was our concern. And then we didn't know if that would be changing our tax bracket or anything.
Yes, it certainly could, because we live in a country where it's a progressive system. So the more you make, the higher the tax bracket. But that's where working with a CPA, the CPA could determine what the tax liability would be based on the other income you have and the amount that's being withdrawn in any given year, and give you a pretty good idea of how much you need to withhold from each withdrawal. You could go ahead and send that into the IRS immediately as an estimated payment. And then that would already be there and it would be acknowledged on your tax return at filing time.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
And the reason he's setting up this way is this, with my brother's age, he's in his 80s. It could be that we need a lot of money at one time because he needs to be in a rest home of some sort or something for his mental illness home where it's, you know, thousands of dollars a month instead of spending the amount that he needs to get by for groceries and rent.
Okay.
Or something like that, which is smaller. Because he does have Social Security and other things, but he just doesn't have enough, and he doesn't have the determination to handle what he has.
Yeah.
He's brilliant, but he doesn't have any money smarts.
Okay, very good. Well, I like this. I think this is a great plan. And the nice thing about you working with a CPA is you could, you know, have somebody else, a third party, telling you how much you need to withhold, which allows you to, you know, document exactly what's withheld and the tax liability that's paid. And if you hold too much back, well, you know, you could take care of it the next year. But I think that's a good plan. Ultimately, it's going to be your responsible because the money has been left to you, even though there's this kind of side understanding that it's for the benefit of your sibling. But you would be the one responsible for managing it and therefore paying the taxes as well.
Okay, that makes good sense. So I'll find a CPA that lives close to where I am.
Yes. I think that sounds like a great idea. Julie, you sound like a wonderful sister, and we appreciate your call today. If we can help further, let us know. Let's quickly go to Omaha. Mitchell, I have just a moment left. How can I help?
Hey, I am 24, and I have not started any savings. So I guess I kind of have a two-part question. How should I start being younger and having a little bit more time for saving? And how much of my income should I be putting in? And should that get more as I get older or less?
It's a great question, Mitchell. Are you talking about long-term retirement savings, or are you talking about what I call your emergency fund?
Long-term.
Okay, yeah. The key would be, I would say just in priority order, make sure you're giving systematically. I think that's a great beginning point. Second, you want to make sure you're living below your means. You want to make sure you have a fully funded emergency fund, 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. And you want to make sure you have no high interest consumer debt, namely credit cards. Assuming you can check all those boxes, I would say this is a great time to begin saving for the long term. I would use a company sponsored retirement plan if you've got one at work, and you could start at a minimum with whatever matching is made available, if there is any. Typically, it might be 3 or 4 or 5%, maybe 6. Definitely put in that much. Ultimately, your goal is to put in 10 to 15% of your pay toward retirement. That could be in a company-sponsored plan. If you don't have one, then a Roth IRA would be a great alternative. And if they're not matching, you may want to start with the Roth and then go to the company-sponsored plan. But I think that goal is giving regularly, living within your means on a budget, 3 to 6 months emergency funds, no high-interest consumer debt, and then ultimately 10 to 15% in long-term savings. And the great news is you've got probably 40 years to let this compound. So if you just do a little bit every month and get it invested, you'll be amazed at how much you'll amass over time. In fact, sooner rather than later, you'll be having to answer the question, how much is enough, and hopefully accelerate your giving even more. But we appreciate your call today, Mitchell. I hope that helps you. Hey, stay on the line. I'm going to send you Ron Blue's book, Master Your Money. I think that'll be helpful to you. That's going to do it for us. Let me say a big thanks to my team today. Certainly couldn't do this without them. Handling our phones today was Adam Suddeth. Producing and engineering today, Mr. Devin Patrick. And providing me with great research today and just helping navigate the program is Jim Henry. If you want to support our work, every gift doubled until the end of the year at faithfi.com. Just click give, and we'll see you tomorrow.